Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo.
Und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Boards-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur. Und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.
I work as a correctional officer in a maximum security prison. Now, saying that probably brings up all sorts of images and ideas, but just know that the job is very different than what you see on TV. There are no nightly escape attempts, no big throwdowns on the yard every afternoon, and if your roommates are drunk, it's because they've been smuggling things out of the kitchen for weeks. Night shift, which was C shift, is not generally very exciting, but it does have its quirks. For example, all the guards on C shift knew about the mysterious shower in Quad 2 of confinement. At first, it was just a curiosity to help pass the time, a mystery to be solved, or some bit of annoyance that inmates could complain about ceaselessly. No one could have known how bad it would get in the end. I've been an officer in the confinement unit of this prison pretty much since I got certified. There's a real need for male officers in an all-male facility. Shocking, I know, and the confinement unit is no different. Typically, the crew is small, each one filling a desired need. And in the 2 years I've been here, I've seen and heard some things that you don't see on TV. I've heard hits planned out through the back grating in the windows. I've had all manner of things thrown at me through the flaps which we push their food and clothes in through. I've been called some pretty colourful names, and I've stumbled across my fair share of bodies, hanging and bleeding, which needed immediate medical attention. Shower 5, though, was definitely the weirdest thing I've ever seen. I couldn't begin to tell you why. I doubt anyone could. But sometimes, when you put an inmate in Shower 5, they would reappear in Shower 3. For those unfamiliar with how a prison quad is set up, let me explain. Each quad holds 28 cells, 14 on the bottom floor and 14 on the top floor, accessible by a catwalk. There are 5 showers in each quad. Showers 1 and 5 are on either side of cell 1 and 14. Showers 2 and 4 are on either side of 15 and 28. And shower 3 sits between 21 and 22. We shower 2 quads a night, which roughly takes about 3 to 4 hours, and makes up the biggest part of our night. Quad 2's shower night was Monday, Wednesday and Friday. Inmates are cuffed, removed from cells, weighed, given haircuts, and are placed in the showers so we can search their cells. They're given roughly 15 minutes to wash and dry off before we come to cuff them and return them to their cells. While they're showering, they're locked in a shower cell about the size of, well, a household shower, while we go to the next quad over to do pretty much the same thing. Sometime within that 15-minute window, the inmate will close their eyes, to blink, or maybe rinse their hair, and suddenly appear in shower 3. It would happen anywhere from 2 to 4 times a month at first. It was never anything you could count on, and we'd sometimes take bets on when it would happen. It never happened in reverse either. Shower 3 was broken, so we never used it. But when we did put an inmate in shower 3 for holding, he never went anywhere until we were ready for him to go somewhere. The shower was a mystery. A mystery that provided a much needed break from a tedious job. And for the first 4 months, we laughed at the looks on the faces of the confused inmates who appeared in shower 3 with a head full of shampoo or frantically searching for a towel that wasn't there. It was all fun and games, until inmate Ferris disappeared. Inmate Ferris was one of the few who didn't request shower 5 every shower night. The others fought like cats to get this stall each shower night, and I'd come into quad many nights to the sound of them bickering about who would get it tonight, or trying to trade their breakfast trays for someone's spot in the line. One inmate in particular, Garvey, used the trader's breakfast tray for the spot in line that would get him to shower 5 every shower night. He showered there 9 shower nights for every 10, and still never had it happen. One night in particular, we had just packed him away and put the next man into shower 5, only to return to find shower 3 occupied, shower 5 empty, and Garvey pouting like an angry child. They all tried, but in truth, and none of them got to experience it like Ferris did. When it came for Ferris to go, he said he wasn't going to shower 5. Normally this wouldn't have been a problem. There were usually tons of others willing to take his place. But tonight, Ferris was my last shower. Garvey immediately started hooting about wanting to take his place, but I ignored him. And that night, all I was thinking about was the food waiting for me in the fridge and the prospect of being done with another night of showers. There was also the matter of Ferris's smell. Ferris had been refusing his showers for the last 7 shower nights. The other shift didn't quite enforce the rules as we did about bathing once a week, and the administration had begun to take notice of his odour. They had sent down orders after the latest inspection that Ferris would shower tonight, on his own or with assistance. "Look, Ferris, you're going in that shower. It's the only one I have available, and you're my last shower." "I ain't going in that shower," he said evenly as he stared at me through the glass on the door. I waved Purvis off as he started walking towards us, not wanting to spook Ferris and create a situation where there didn't need to be one. "Look, Ferris, we can do this the easy way or the hard way. If you refuse the shower, I can get a bunch of angry men down here to pull you out and put you in the shower. Or you could be an adult and go take your shower so we can be done here. What's it gonna be?" He argued for a bit, but in the end, he put on the cuffs and went to shower 5 meekly. I will always regret making him go. He was praying when I closed the shower door. He was very religious, and a shower that made people vanish was something he neither trusted nor understood. I closed him in and took off his cuffs, and at first, I didn't think he would take the shower at all. But as I descended the stairs, I heard the water start, and decided to make a trip to the officer's station to have a quick bite. 15 minutes later, I returned to find 3 occupied showers and 2 empty showers. Well, not exactly empty, I suppose. Ferris's towel still hung off the door, and his soap dish was sitting on the ledge, but there was no sign of inmate Ferris. Purvis looked around, not quite understanding what had happened, and wondered out loud if we'd filled all the showers before we left. I said we had, and Purvis and I spent the next hour searching every shower, every cell in the quad, and every cell and shower in the other 3 quads too. We checked the CCTV in the station, but there was no video of him leaving the shower. The video showed him showering 1 minute, and then gone the next. The strange shower hadn't disappeared Ferris to a different shower this time. It had simply made him disappear. The next 3 nights were a nightmare. Ferris's disappearance prompted an emergency search of all dorms, a compound-wide lockdown, the dispatching of the K-9 team, and a countrywide manhunt that extended into neighboring countries before it was finally called off after a fruitless 2 weeks. For 3 days we were questioned, had to make multiple written and verbal statements, and were grilled endlessly by both local and federal officers. The cameras clearly showed that we had been absent from the quad when Ferris disappeared. So, after 3 days, they had no choice but to let us return to work. We weren't sure what to make of the incident, but we chalked it all up to the strangeness with Shower 5 and went about work as usual. We didn't use Shower 5 anymore though. It seemed like the strange magic had finally turned sour, and after finally making maintenance come down and fix Shower 3, we stopped using it entirely. We didn't see Ferris for another 3 months. I've said we a lot in this story, but I haven't talked about the men I served with in confinement. Purvis was our muscle, 6 feet tall and built like a barrel, and I'm pretty sure all the inmates thought he communicated through grunts and the occasional, "Go to hell." If you weren't an inmate though, He was one of the nicest guys you'd ever care to know. I've spent many afternoons on his back porch with a beer in my hand and the smell of steak on the grill as I chatted with the third member of our trio. McMahon, Sergeant McMahon, was a 10-year vet who spent most of his time doing paperwork or fielding questions from the brass. He let us handle most of the day-to-day drudgery while he insulated us in a warm blanket of correctly managed reports and accurately maintained logs. McMahon was far from what you'd call imposing, standing about 5'2" with thick glasses and a slim frame. But he was knowledgeable about his job and always had something to talk about. He was the last sergeant I ever served with in that confinement unit. 3 months passed and Ferris's disappearance was starting to fade. After the inquiries and inquests determined we'd had nothing to do with the disappearance, they put us back in confinement and told us to keep a closer watch in the future. We talked about it sometimes, speculating what could have happened to him, but ultimately, we lost interest after the paperwork ended and the hype died down. He was gone, and we still had a job to do, so the showers went on and days turned into weeks. It was a Sunday when he came back. Sundays were normally a pretty easy day in confinement. We didn't do showers on Sunday night, and the night was spent cleaning and passing out toiletries and generally just finding something online to watch as we ran out the clock. We brought food in to share most Sundays, and this was no exception. I brought chicken, Purvis brought soda, and McMahon brought a pecan pie that his sister had made. By 9 o'clock, we had caught up our paperwork, passed out all our toiletries, and were full as ticks and ready to find a movie. I had my feet kicked up on my desk and was getting ready to enjoy a nap when the sound of boots on doors started in Quad 2. Purvis looked up from the screen and sighed. I knew it was too good to be true. We headed out into the quad to see what all the kicking was about. As Purvis and I came through the door, we were buffeted by screams of "Shower 3!" and "It's Ferris!" and "He's dying!" We came up the stairs two at a time, and what I saw will haunt me until the day I die. I'd seen men get hurt in this line of work. I'd seen men get stabbed, and I'd watched a few men die. But I had never seen anything to top this level of cruelty. It was Ferris, all right. We'd arrived in time to see his last few breaths and listen to him wheeze as his lungs finished filling with blood. He lay on the floor of the dirty shower, his blood pooling as it tried to flow into the drain, and shuddered out the last minutes of his life. He was naked, and we were saved having to look at his mutilated genitalia because of the fetal position he'd taken. A nurse would later tell us that they had been cut and sliced cruelly before he died, and his stomach and intestines were a mess of punctured tissue. We didn't know about this until later, but what we could see was horrific enough. His skin had been sliced by long claws, and his back looked as though something had tried to peel him a strip at a time. His arms, his legs, his neck, his face, and especially his back were bloody tatters, and when he finally died, I considered it a true mercy. "Go get the Sarge," Purvis said, and I was relegated to the bubble while McMahon went to the floor to access the situation. They took Ferris out under a sheet, and it was dripping red in its wake. This started a whole new bombardment of paperwork, CCTV footage being combed over a frame at a time, and witness statements being filled out and dispositions being taken. Luckily, we had done our rounds on time. One of us was on camera not even 30 minutes before he disappeared in the shower, and it was agreed upon that the incident had been no negligence of ours. The narrative they constructed was as unsatisfying as it was unbelievable, but it kept our bacon out of the fire, so we didn't argue. Ferris had managed to worm his way into the grates through the shower and had made it into the ventilation system. The other inmates had likely been feeding him and telling him to stop moving. This was before audio was normal in the dorms, so we couldn't check. And after 3 months, he'd gotten bored and wandered into one of the big fans and gotten cut up. He'd drug himself back into the shower 3 this time, and called for help, and that's where we found him. No inmate admitted to having talked to Ferris since he disappeared, and no blood was ever found in the vents. But this was a much better narrative than a shower that kept sending inmates from one shower to another. Sometimes the administration just wanted paperwork to look good. Making sense was secondary. After that, no inmate would go near Shower 5. It spread the compound seemingly overnight, and any inmate that came into Quad 2 would refuse to go into Shower 5. We were more than happy to oblige the request. One more weird occurrence, and they pull us all out and separate us between the other dorms. We all liked being where we were, and were in no hurry to get sent somewhere else. For the next month, we kept a low profile and tried our best to keep disturbances to a minimum. If we needed a reminder of the incident, all we had to do was look at the red stains on the floor of Shower 3. We managed to keep the weirdness to a minimum for about a month before it came completely off the rails. Purvis and I were conducting showers in Quad 3 and 4 when they brought in our latest wild child. Everett was what we'd call a frequent flyer, and had we known he was coming in, we'd have put him in the cell they'd just released him from 3 days ago. He'd gotten into another fight, probably over gang politics, and now he was sitting in the Sally Port again and cussing up a storm. When they asked us where we wanted him, we didn't even think about Shower 5. We told them to just put him in the shower on the other side and we'd deal with him later. I don't know if he said something to them or not, but they later told us that they'd loaded him into Shower 5, leaving the cuffs on because he was being combative, and left. We finished showers late that night, and just about the time my butt air at the chair, I remembered Everett. I haven't heard a peep out of him. Did they load him into a cell? McMahon looked at his board and shook his head. Pretty sure they put him in a shower. A quick look through the glass told us that he wasn't in one of the ground floor showers. How could he be? We had used all the bottom showers to shower the other quads. When we asked them why they had put him in Shower 5, they answered that it had been funny to watch him pee his pants in fear of the mystery shower. It was far less funny after the events of that night. We were preparing to go put him away when a chorus of screams brought our attention to the quad. The inmates were screaming, terrified wails that only the doomed are capable of, and the whole quad was going nuts. We could all see the door to Shower 5, heaving and bucking as something slammed into it with a machine gun-like rhythm. That wasn't like any kicking I'd ever heard, and added to the screaming, it put me on edge. Shower 5 had become something sinister. Something not altogether understandable, and I did not want to see what new horror it had in store for us. I started to move, despite my apprehension, but McMahon stopped me. I've got this. Call the captain and get some help down here while we go see what's going on. His actions saved me. He and Purvis left the station in a hurry, piling up at the door as they hunted for keys, and came through the door one behind the other as they mounted the steps. They were at the top of the stairs and heading towards the shower when the door to Shower 5 buckled outward. The door was reinforced metal, and whatever was on the other side had separated it from one of its hinges. The hinge hung lamely, concrete still clinging to it, as something dark and groping tried to climb through the hole. The snapping mouth glistened in the overhead lights as the creature scrambled and pushed to be free of its prison. I saw Purvis take a step back, bumping into McMahon as the two tried to process what was happening, and all thoughts of calling for help had fled from me as I watched the events unfold. The creature freed itself from the hole, black goo glistening on the torn door, and made its way up the wall with a hellish shriek and a metallic clittering I could hear through the glass. The whole quad had started screaming, and their hellish chorus was only drowned out by the creature's screams of pain as it left a glistening trail behind it on the concrete wall. The two officers, my friends, stood like statues as the thing swung its eyeless head from side to side. It seemed to be confused by all the screaming, the sound bouncing off the concrete, and I thought my fellow officers might escape as Purvis took another tentative step backward. That's when McMahon started screaming. I'd seen McMahon face down even the most hardened of inmates, seen him hold the line during last summer's riots as we held the gate against dozens of screaming inmates. But this creature was too much for him. He screamed, and it cut across the hellish sound of the quad like a knife through butter. The creature then turned its eyeless face towards him, and the front of its bulbous mouth split open to reveal lines of serrated teeth and a high-pitched sound like a piece of farm equipment scream. It leapt, coming stickily off the wall, but its path took it straight into Purvis, who was frozen in front of the screaming sergeant. It rode him to the ground, knocking McMahon off his feet, and the strange mouth ripped itself open to reveal the rows of black glistening teeth. Its mouth dove, and it tore chunks of flesh out of the screaming man as McMahon scooted backwards in a state of sheer terror. He reached for his gas, a small can of chemical spray that is normally our best defense against aggressive inmates, but his hand seemed unsure of how to break the seal that held it in the holster, or even whether or not he wanted to. The creature, meanwhile, of a quickly exsanguinating Purvis. Purvis was not a small man. I had seen him lay hands on men who would have given me trouble and put them on their faces as easily as someone subdues a child. Purvis was straining against the thing as it tore strips out of his shirt, his undershirt, and his chest, but his biceps were losing purchase and he was starting to weaken. The creature raised its muzzle all at once and bit down on his face, engulfing the man's head in a single bite. And as Purvis kicked and thrashed under it, I saw McMahon get to his feet and make a run for it. The catwalk had 2 points of egress, and McMahon seemed to think that if he could get to the other side, he could elude the creature and put the solid steel door between them. He almost did too, until the creature looked up from the stripped skull it was now chewing on and heard him running down the stairs. It leapt frog-like and hit one of the overhead lights, and the cage light swung drunkenly before falling to the concrete with a shower of glass and twisted bars. As it fell, the creature leapt off of it and caught McMahon in the back as he ran for the door. The door is framed by 2 large glass windows that stand about 25 feet high, so you can glance out at the quad and see what's happening at any given time. The creature slammed into McMahon and plastered him against one of these windows like a bug. His nose broke, his glasses shattered, and as he slid down, I could follow his progress with a trail of blood he'd left. The only thing visible was one hand spasmodically grasping at the impenetrable barrier between him and freedom as the creature devoured him. I didn't know what to do. I just stood there with the phone in one hand, dial tone blaring at me, and the radio in the other hand, putting out the same good-natured chatter it usually does at this time at night. It was so weird to think that somewhere else in the compound, there were people having normal nights. While my 2 best friends were being devoured before my eyes, there were actually people out there having comfortable nights filled with nothing more pressing than a bellyache or an unruly inmate who wouldn't go to bed. It didn't even seem possible that our universes could be on the same plane of existence. I think that's when my mind snapped. Or maybe it was when I looked up from the radio and saw the creature looking at me, its eyeless face staring straight at me, that my mind simply unraveled. I let the phone slip out of my hand, let the radio clatter to the desk, and simply curled in a ball on the floor. I don't know how long I was there, but when I came back to, the captain was shaking me, and all hell had truly broken loose. They had come in after I didn't answer the radio. They had used the emergency keys to come into the station and found me on the ground in a catatonic state. They had then looked out and seen the blood splattering on the window and feared that a riot was underway. They had assembled their response team, a 7-man team with riot gear, and proceeded into the quad. As I looked out into the shadowy hellscape, I could see that several of the cells had been opened somehow, and there was a lot more blood on the floor than I remembered. The remains of body armor and broken shotguns lay everywhere, and the lights in the quad seemed to be in a constant state of flicker. The team had gone in and been attacked by what they thought was a mountain lion or some kind of big cat. They had been ripped to shreds in a matter of minutes, and only the team leader had managed to escape after throwing a flash grenade in the thing's face. It had battered the door a little while trying to get at him, but had eventually gone back to eating the remains of the other six members. The team leader said it looked like some of the other inmates had been killed, though he couldn't figure out how this thing was getting into the cells. They looked to me for answers, but I had none. The team leader joined me in the fetal ball in the corner while the captain made calls for backup. I sat in that station for the next 2 days, nodding off when sleep finally took me, and watched as the state police and animal control tried to figure out how to get this thing out of the quad. After the third police officer was ripped to shreds, we got a visit from someone higher up. He told us that the quad was to be quarantined until further notice, the reflective lenses on his sunglasses making him look as inhuman as the creature, and that no one was to go in or out until this thing was dead. The captain asked him what we should do about the men trapped inside, men who hadn't eaten in 2 days, and he simply shrugged and said, if they were in there, then they were as good as dead already. That thing isn't going to let anyone out once they're in, and a rescue attempt isn't going to do anything but lose you more men. Don't worry though, we'll make it so no one who's gone through that door ever existed. He was true to his word too. McMahon and Purvis were unmarried bachelors, and so they could just disappear one day after work. Of the 27 inmates that had been in that quad, I don't know. Their files were gone when I came back. Their DC numbers and CDC records were expunged, and all the cells were open and empty. The doors to Quad 2 were sealed shut, the door welded closed, and caution tape draped across it. I was offered McMahon's position as confinement sergeant. I took it, not because I wanted it, but because I felt it was my sacred trust to stand guard against that thing every night. I've never seen it during the day. It doesn't seem to like the light. But at night, you can catch glimpses of it in the darkness as it stalks the rats and roaches that still live in the quad. The new officers they put back there always ask me what happened to Quad 2. But I never tell them the whole story. If they knew, they might try to get its attention and add more blood to my hands. I've seen officers come and go in the 10 years since that day, but I haven't told anyone about the incident. My captain is a major now at another facility. Everyone from my old shift has either quit or moved on, and I alone keep my vigil here every night. Sometimes I see him in the semi-darkness, looking at me and thinking. After 10 years, I imagine he's hungry for something more than rats. Maybe in another 10 years, he'll question how thick that glass is between him and real meat. When he does, I'll be here.